and Still I Rise. I spoke to them at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Happy birthday to our archivist, Brendan Allen. Democracy Now! Has several job openings. We're hiring a broadcast engineer, as well as a director of finance and operations, and a director of development. You can go to democracynow.org for more information. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Al, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Chirina Nadura, Juan Carlos Davila, Pedro Rodriguez. Special thanks to John Hamilton and Nicole Salazar. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 4:59. Stay tuned for the KBOO Tuesday Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Wamba at the Analog Cafe, Friday, February 19th at 10 p.m. Wamba is a Portland-based band that mixes traditional West African rhythms from Ghana with jazz, funk, and Afrobeat styles. Friday, February 19th, there will be a special two-set performance. The evening starts at 10 p.m. at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification, a public lecture by Jeff Halper, Tuesday, February 23rd at 7 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church in Portland. Jeff Halper is the longtime head of the Israel Committee Against House Demolitions and is known for his activism on the ground in support of Palestinian rights and a just peace. Jeff will be on a book tour for his recently published book, War Against the People. Again, that's War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification, a public lecture by Jeff Halper, Tuesday, February 23rd at 7 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church, 1838 Southwest Jefferson in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a bill is being rushed through the Oregon legislature to keep secret the names of police officers.
At Yellowstone National Park, it's the season for culling the buffalo herd.
And the Clark County Commission on Aging is focusing all its public forums for the rest of the year on housing. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 16th, 2016. I'm Jenny Okuyama.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. Police accountability activists are worried about a bill before the Oregon State Legislature tonight. Within 24 hours of a shooting involving a police officer, the name of the officer or officers involved are typically released to the public. Oregon House Bill 4087 seeks to change this by allowing Oregon police the ability to request legal anonymity of officers in 90-day blocks. According to the bill, this can be requested from a judge if an officer suffers a, quote, credible threat of present danger. While an investigation is pending, the names of those involved in the shooting and killing of Malheur Wildlife Refuge protester Lavoy Finicum have been withheld. Local grassroots organization Portland Cop Watch works to monitor and also promote the accountability of Portland's police force. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke today with activist Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch to get his perspective on what's at stake with this legislation.
Dan Handelman, Portland Cop Watch, can you tell us about this bill that's in the state legislature right now?
Yes, House Bill 4087 is being rushed through the Oregon State Legislature, and the intention is to allow police officers to have their names withheld if they or their family are facing a serious threat in the aftermath of a police shooting. And it's specifically being done because of the shooting that happened in eastern Oregon related to the occupation out there. But because it's being rushed through, there's been no public discussion, and our concern at Portland Cop Watch is that this bill is going to have unintended consequences, because in order for a police officer to file a complaint saying they're afraid for their life, it's going to take a couple of days for them to get that together and find out whether they have a threat to their life. So there's going to be a delay before going to the judge. Then the judge has 5 days to decide whether or not the threat's real and accept or reject this request. And then if they agree, then it's at least 90 days before the officer's name is released. Right now in Portland, we get the names of the officers within 24 hours of a shooting, and that's just going to stop immediately if this thing passes.
Let me ask you, just for people that don't understand the gravity of what you're talking about, why does it matter when we find out which officer may have been implicated in a shooting? Why is this issue important?
Yeah, the example I'm using is Officer Ron Frashauer, the guy who shot Aaron Campbell in the back in January of 2010. And Officer Frashauer already had a tainted history that some of us in the community knew about, so we were able to make those connections right away as soon as the name came out. And if an officer were to be able to hold their name forever from the public if they were involved in the shooting, Frashauer was fired, and he was put back on the force by an arbitrator. He could be walking among us, and we would never know that he was the cop that shot Aaron Campbell in the back, because we would never learn his name. And right now, the movement is working on making sure that Frashauer gets assigned to a desk job so he can't walk the streets anymore and be a threat to our community. If we never learn the names of the officers involved in these shootings, we won't have that ability anymore.
That was KBOO's Lisa Loving with activist Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch.
A bill that will ban the import of seafood caught by enslaved laborers will be making its way to President Obama this week. The new proposal is an attempt to close a loophole in an 85-year-old trade law that has failed to stop products of forced and child labor from making its way into the United States. The current 1930 trade law allows the import of products that have been caught or made by enslaved laborers if there is enough consumer demand. The bill is the result of an Associated Press investigation that found Thai companies importing seafood into the U.S. that was caught and processed by enslaved laborers. Such seafood was found making its way to major U.S. retailers and restaurants such as Walmart, Whole Foods, and Red Lobster. The bill, which also revamps several trade laws and bans internet taxes, has already passed the Senate. President Obama is expected to sign the bill into law.
Residents of the town of Prineville are anticipating another large data center. Speculation comes after Prineville annexed 168 acres near the airport. Crook County has rezoned the land from agricultural to industrial use in response to a request from the landowner. Legacy Ranches, a Chicago-based developer that owns the land, won't say what it wants to do with the property, but at public meetings, company representatives alluded to plans for a data center. Oregon attracts tech company data centers due to tax breaks that exempt server computers from property taxes. Facebook and Apple already have massive data facilities in town, including Facebook's latest 487,000 square foot facility, which will be Oregon's largest when completed. The Bend Bulletin noted that Legacy Ranches shares a Chicago address with Excelsior, a financial brokerage firm known to be involved in controversial high-frequency trading investment practices.
California farmers are known for producing some of the finest fruits, vegetables, and nuts in the world. But what if big agriculture here also included marijuana? Backers of a measure to legalize pot have started collecting signatures. If it makes it onto the November ballot and passes, California growers might have a new crop to harvest. Ezra David Romero has the story.
California farmers are known for producing some of the finest fruits, vegetables, and nuts in the world. But what if big agriculture here also included marijuana? Backers of a measure to legalize marijuana have started collecting signatures, and if it makes it onto the November ballot and passes, California growers might have a new crop to harvest. As KVPR's Ezra David Romero reports, some Central Valley farmers are already eyeing that possibility.
A few years ago, Los Banos farmer Cannon Michael discovered a one-acre illegal marijuana grow on his land.
They'd made reservoirs and they were pumping water. They'd buried generators. They had this whole encampment, and we knew nothing about it.
He says the forbidden plantation was worth around $19 million. That's more than he makes on 11,000 acres of tomatoes, cotton, and other crops in 1 year. That got him thinking.
So I don't know. I guess if I put in a 200-acre planting of marijuana, would the market sustain that?
Cannabis becoming a major player in big agriculture depends on whether Californians vote to legalize pot. If it passes, the state would still have to develop regulations on how it can be grown, and farmers would have to figure out which crops grow best. Even still, becoming a big grower early on makes sense for farmers like Ken and Michael, who have land and resources.
To me, it's just another potential option for something that could be a benefit to the farm and then also make some money, hopefully.
But small farmers already growing legal medical marijuana say they don't want big ag to push out smaller existing farms.
I don't really see any clear benefit.
That's Hezekiah Allen with the California Growers Association, representing over 500 members.
Certainly our hope is that we kind of avoid consolidation and we don't really move in that direction.
Allen does think there is one big role farms can play, growing hemp, which has lower THC levels and can be used to make paper, cloth, and soap. Even if marijuana cultivation becomes legal across the state, a big question still looms. Will law enforcement crack down on these new growers if cannabis remains illegal under federal law? Federal raids on medical marijuana are still happening in California. Some local sheriffs are going after pot farms, too.
You can still see how big these plants are right here.
Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims, for example, has waged an all-out war on marijuana, raiding grows not only in cities, but in the Sierra Nevada and on farmland.
For me, it really started out as the violence issue, home invasion robberies, the homicides, the assaults with a deadly weapon. All of that started increasing in these large marijuana grows.
Her officers have encountered gangs, booby traps, and military-grade weapons at grow sites.
If we again start allowing people to have these large grows, the violence will go up again.
She hopes whatever initiative passes includes some sort of control by local law enforcement.
As long as that happens, we're all going to come out ahead, because then cities and counties can make up their own minds about what they want to do with their own land use ordinances.
She also doesn't think farmers used to growing peaches or tomatoes will want to pay taxes and fees that could come with legalizing the marijuana crop. But companies that sell supplies for growing medical marijuana say they're getting ready for a boom if big ag gets in on the game. At Current Culture H2O, a hydroponics company in Fresno, Christian Long sells water-based systems to help people grow all sorts of plants and vegetables. But most of his business comes from people growing cannabis. Today he's working on a system with 12 tubs connected together with PVC pipes to grow broccoli.
So their roots just grow right down into the water.
This is a system that could be used on large-scale farms.
We're not leaving the hobby segment, but we're creating a whole new segment in our business that's specifically for commercial.
He's expanding his warehouse by 22,000 feet, anticipating that orders will increase if the pot measure passes later this fall. For the California Report, I'm Ezra David Romero in Fresno.
The All African People's Revolutionary Party is an international pan-Africanist movement with a branch right here in Portland. The organization offers an international frame for addressing key problems facing the Black community. The Portland AAPRP serves a hot breakfast twice a week for dozens of children at the New Columbia Housing Project in North Portland. Here to talk with us about it is Ajamu Umi. Ajamu, thanks for coming in tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, you're very welcome. So to start off, let's talk about the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Who participates with the AAPRP and what is it that you guys do?
So like you said, the AAPRP is an international Pan-African political party. We have chapters all throughout Africa, in Europe, throughout what we call the United Snakes of America and the Caribbean and South America. And our objective is Pan-Africanism, which we define as one unified socialist Africa. So in lay terms, what that means is we believe that the capitalist system was built and is maintained on exploiting Africa and African people, as well as everyone else on the planet. So we don't believe that we can ever have the dignity and freedom and self-determination as African people until Africa is free, united, and socialist. So anybody of African descent is active within the AAPRP, but because we know we're not waging this struggle in isolation, we have strong alliance and working relationships with other people around the world who are also fighting for the same freedom, justice, and liberation.
And why did you guys decide to start the free hot breakfast program? What was the motivation behind that?
Well, one of the main things is that, you know, we always are looking for new and creative ways to organize in the community. And because there's such a propaganda war against the word socialism, you know, people in America want everything that's socialist. They don't want student debt. They want free education. They don't want health medical bills. They want health care, free health care. Mm-hmm. They want quality living conditions. They want all these things. But if you say the word socialism, which all those things are, then people don't want it because we've been programmed not to want it. So we wanted to create a project that would demonstrate to people what community looks like when people are taking care of their needs, because that's really what socialism is. So that's why we wanted to start the free breakfast program. It was always intended to be the first part of an intensive program that we wanted to wage to raise the political education among people in the community about the need to stand up and organize against this system, because this system is killing us. If it's not killing us physically on the streets by corrupt terrorist police, then it's killing us through poverty. It's killing us through healthcare disparities. It's killing us through environmental issues. It's killing us all these ways. So, you know, we have to come together as community to stop it. No politician, no nonprofit, none of those types of things are going to solve our problem. The only thing that's going to solve them is the organized masses.
And is this particular program, the free hot breakfast program, is that modeled after another program? Was that sort of something that came up organically?
No, absolutely. Of course, the free breakfast program we facilitate is modeled after the one that the Black Panther Party initiated in 1968 around the country here. You know, those are our big brothers and sisters, our uncles and our aunties. And, you know, we talk to them often and they give us much inspiration. Brother Kent Ford, who started the Black Panther Party chapter here in Portland, is often comes to our breakfast program, and just him coming in the room and sharing his stories and experiences is for me always a huge inspiration. So, you know, we always thank those that came before us. So we're just simply trying to carry on the tradition of self-determination that the Panthers initiated in the late 60s.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how does the free hot breakfast program work exactly? How does that function?
Well, it operates every Monday and Friday at this point. We've been doing it since April, so we're moving into a year of doing it. Wow. And we have it takes place at the Columbia International Coffee Shop, which is at 9022 North Newman here in Portland. And the reason why we chose the New Columbia neighborhood is we did research and we found that New Columbia has the highest concentration of people of African descent in the entire state of Oregon. So we wanted to focus an organizing effort there. So we forged that relationship and we began to solicit donations for food and get a network of people who are going to consistently support us. And we prepared ourselves to support ourselves, to be able to come out the pocket as we needed to support the program as well. And so then we just went door to door and started talking to people and building relationships with people in the community and telling people about it. And it's taken time, but now people, we see the same children coming. They come often. If there's a holiday and they forget that we're not going to be there, they come. And then the next time they tell us, where were you? We don't know. We came and you all weren't here last time. So they're becoming institutionalized and expecting the program. You know, we feed pancakes, oatmeal, the breakfast sandwiches, eggs, vegetables, fruit, juice, fresh juice. But then we also have information that we feed the children. We write poems for them. The poems are based in the struggle of our people for liberation and the struggle of all humanity for liberation. So, you know, we're trying to spend a lot of time with them to inspire them, let them know they're important. So those are some of the components that we do with the program.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it sounds like the breakfast is like anyone would want. Who would say no to pancakes?
It's good food.
Tell us a little bit more about the kind of kids who are coming in for breakfast. Give us a little, draw us a picture of that.
So there isn't any one model. I mean, there are elementary school children, middle school children, high school children. There are some there are people that are children at heart that come in. There are children of all nationalities. We don't turn anyone away. You know, we have children from all backgrounds that come in. But everybody that come in, they're going to hear about the African struggle, the African liberation struggle. And they'll hear about how it connects to them, why it should mean something to them. And then we also have, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on listening to the children. And then, you know, from doing that, we've evolved into field trips. We take the children on field trips. We took several children to Powell's Books last month, allowed each of them to buy a book and spent a lot of time just talking to them. And then out of this, the breakfast program, or at least partially out of the breakfast program, a lot of the parents out there have indicated a desire to see a school emerge, an independent school. So now we're working on starting a Saturday school out there that can, again, address these cultural, political needs that we have as a community that the state structures are not only not designed to address, but really to repress, in our opinion.
And can you tell us a little bit more about how did you organize it? How did you organize everything? Did you get help from the school district? Do you have partners?
No help from any organized system. Again, it's important, just like the Black Panther Party did it, for this program to be independent. That way we can say what we want. We can do what we want. You know, we can talk about Africa, which we do. We can talk about revolution. We can talk about socialism, and nobody's coming to yank funding away because the funding comes out of our pockets. So we don't have any ties to any organization or any agency or anything like that. Whatever funding we get comes from the people. Every time that we talk about it, like I'm doing now, people go to www.aaprporegon.org and they donate money, and they don't even write notes. They just donate money. Some people donate $5. Some people donate $300. But it's been more than enough to keep this program going without any real threat to our existence for the last year. So, you know, our message and what we've learned from that is that, again, the people can come together and solve problems. We don't need these agencies that were created, in our view, to repress us. So that it works very well the way it's working right now.
Well, thank you so much, Ajamu. We really appreciate you coming in. That was Ajamu Umi with the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Find out more about their work on their Facebook page.
The annual slaughter of buffalo has begun by officials at Yellowstone National Park. Around 900 buffalo are going to be killed in an effort to reduce the herd's numbers as they attempt to migrate north into the neighboring state of Montana. The controversial mitigation over the number of buffalo began in the 1990s after Montana sued the National Park Service for allowing buffalo herds to enter into state lands. Activist Mike Meese of the Buffalo Field Campaign spoke with KBOO's Chris Andre.
Some 5,000, and the beautiful thing is they were going to start, ironically, on President's Day, capturing and sending buffalo to slaughter, but the buffalo are too smart, and they walk back into the park, so we have all these agents running around looking for buffalo to kill, and they're not there. They walked further back into the park to their safety, so for today, we have good news. The buffalo are allowed to be buffalo. But, you know, when hearing you talk about another First Nations people not allowed to be their own people, and, you know, it's one of the things that hurts my heart so bad is our culture's fear of anything we don't understand or anything we can't control that's wild. And we have to cage it in. We have to police it. We have to never recognize and honor itself for what it gives to this earth. And you know, that's what I hope that people can understand, is that Indigenous people did live in harmony with this earth. The animals live in harmony with this earth. Western culture and progress is what destroys and eliminates this earth. You know, when we think of what we're going to leave our children, you know, air we can't breathe, water we can't drink, food that's GMO and fake. You know, what a legacy we're leaving for our children. And, you know, that's why I look to the buffalo to learn, to watch, to understand how to be. And that is one of the many gifts that they give the people. So I have good news today that they're not capturing and killing buffalo for the time being. But believe me, it's only because the buffalo left. It's not because they've grown tolerant or had their minds enlightened.
Who decides that they're going to kill 900? And then who's out there shooting them? I mean, it must be the most awful, ghastly sight. I want to ask you before we have to let you go today about who decides, okay, 900. And how do they know? What are they doing? Who's doing this? The slaughter?
Well, basically, unfortunately, the sad news is this is being funded by us, the U.S. taxpayer. In 2000, the management plan was derived from the Park Service, the Forest Service, APHIS, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, and the Montana Livestock Department and Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. And so basically the U.S. taxpayer are funding this slaughter, and they set arbitrary numbers, which are ironically dictated by the livestock industry to how they govern this. And so, you know, this week we're trying to bring attention to it, and on Wednesday we have a national call-in day. And if you go to our website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, we have numbers for you to call your local senators and congresspeople and say that you're really not happy with your taxpayer dollars going to kill buffalo for the sole benefit of the Montana livestock industry.
That was KBOO's Chris Andre speaking with activist Mike Meese of the Buffalo Field Campaign.
Men may need to get permission from their wives if they want to get Viagra. A Kentucky state representative has introduced a bill that would require men to get written permission from their wives before getting a prescription for drugs like Viagra. The bill would restrict the availability of erectile dysfunction medications to married men only. Wording in the bill also demands that any user of the drug would have to make a sworn statement with his hand on a Bible that he will only use that drug while having sexual relations with his current spouse. Two doctor's office visits would also be required before a doctor could write a patient a prescription. The representative that introduced the bill, Mary Lou Marizan, a nurse, says the bill is an effort to protect men's health. She also admits that the bill is a response to several anti-abortion measures in the Kentucky legislature. Such measures include Senate Bill 4, which would require women to get counseling from a health professional 24 hours ahead of receiving an abortion. "I want to protect these men from themselves," said Marizan of her bill. "This is about family values." Marizan also plans to file a bill requiring potential gun buyers to obtain counseling 24 hours in advance of purchasing a gun. Counseling would include hearing stories directly from victims of gun violence.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Clark County Senior Services. This will be followed by QTPOC at 6 with host Darian Jones. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is looking rainy. Expect some thundershowers with a high of 61 in the afternoon. Evening showers will follow with a low of 43. Today in history, the first 911 emergency telephone system went into service in 1968. The quote of the day is from Maya Angelou, who said, "My mission in life is not merely to survive, but to thrive, and to do so with some passion, some compassion, some humor, and some style." It is 5:28 p.m. Time for commentary from Jim Hightower.
They say that if you get up in the morning and swallow a live toad, nothing worse will happen to you for the rest of the day. Well, We Americans have just been fed a live toad by the World Trade Organization. Last May, the WTO, an oligarchic, autocratic governing entity essentially run by and for multinational corporations, ruled that a U.S. consumer protection law called COOL violates one of WTO's obscure trade rules. COOL stands for Country of Origin Labeling, a straightforward requirement that meat sold in the U.S. be labeled so consumers can know where it came from. This was passed by our Congress, signed by our President, upheld by our courts, and is supported by 92% of our people. But corporate meat packers in Canada and Mexico, including U.S. meat conglomerates with operations there, do not want us to know this basic information. So they got Canadian and Mexican government officials to do an end run around our sovereign people by filing a claim against COOL in this shadowy corporate trade organization. WTO's May ruling dutifully put the profits of these few global meat purveyors over the democratic will of some 300 million Americans. COOL must go, decreed these faceless, unelected servants of the corporate order. Now for the toad. To enforce this demand, the WTO dictated on December 7th that Canada and Mexico could punish us by imposing $1 billion a year in export bans. Or Washington could give in to the corporate greed and gut our people's consumer labeling law. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure enough, rather than telling the WTO to take a hike, your Congress critters and President Obama meekly swallowed this toad, repealing COOL and signing away your and my sovereignty. To fight this, go to Global Trade Watch at citizen.org/trade.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Four American journalists were released in Bahrain today after being detained last weekend. The journalists were arrested during a pro-democracy demonstration on Sunday. In a statement released by the state-run Bahrain news agency, a prosecutor said, quote, "The individuals were questioned in the presence of lawyers and charged with unlawful obstruction of vehicles and attending unlawful gatherings." Reporter Anna Therese Day of Boise, Idaho, and her three-person camera crew are said to have been released pending further investigation and are currently in Dubai. Day and her camera crew were arrested Sunday during a rally commemorating the fifth anniversary of the Shia-led uprising in Bahrain, which was part of the Arab Spring movement. According to ABC News, Bahraini officials released the four journalists despite charging them, apparently due to the intervention of the U.S. Embassy in Bahrain. Authorities reportedly still have possession of cell phones and computers belonging to Day and her crew. It is expected the journalists will be banned from returning to the country.
Former United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has died today at the age of 93. Boutros-Ghali was an Egyptian diplomat and politician who served as the Vice Foreign Minister of Egypt and was the first African and Arab to hold the position of UN Secretary General. His position as Secretary General saw him dealing with the major global issues of the mid-1990s, including the Rwandan genocide and wars in the former Yugoslavia. Boutros-Ghali often found himself at odds with U.S. Congress and the Clinton administration, which critics cite as the reason for his serving only one term as Secretary General. A minute of silence was observed today by the UN Secretary Council in honor of Boutros-Ghali's passing. Current UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said in a statement today that Boutros-Ghali was, quote, "a well-known scholar of international law and brought formidable experience and intellectual power to the task of piloting the United Nations through one of the most tumultuous and challenging periods in its history."
Russia has denied that their warplane struck a Doctors Without Borders hospital in northern Syria on Monday. The hospital was the target of multiple airstrikes, killing 11 people. Doctors Without Borders said that their hospital was hit four times in attacks that were only minutes apart. The organization claims that they were deliberately targeted and have demanded an investigation. The destruction of the hospital has left an estimated 40,000 people without access to medical care. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said Monday that Russian warplanes targeted the hospital, claims which were echoed by the Turkish prime minister. A spokesperson for President Vladimir Putin categorically denies such accusations, saying that there was no evidence of these claims. The spokesperson stated that the people should rely on primary sources for their information and that the official announcements made from the Syrian government are what Moscow is listening to. He also commented that Syrian's ambassador to Russia reported that it was the U.S. military that destroyed the hospital.
And now it's time for our weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos. The Clark.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Today I'm going to do something completely different with my commentary. I'm going to read excerpts from the lyrics of a song released just a few weeks ago titled White Privilege 2, written by Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. In the words of journalist Taryn Finley, the song lyrics touch on racial tensions, the Black Lives Matter movement, and the toxicity of being passive in one's own white privilege. And now excerpts from White Privilege 2. Pulled into the parking lot, parked it, zipped up my parka, joined the procession of marchers in my head like, is this awkward? Should I even be here marching? Thinking if they can't, how can I breathe? Thinking that they chant, what do I sing? I want to take a stance because we are not free. And then I thought about it. We are not we. Am I in the outside looking in or am I in the inside looking out? Is it my place to give my 2 cents? Or should I stand on the side and shut my mouth? No justice, no peace. Okay, I'm saying that. They're chanting out Black Lives Matter, but I don't say it back. Is it okay for me to say? I don't know, so I watch and stand in front of a line of police that look the same as me, only separated by a badge, a baton, a can of mace, a mask, a shield, a gun with gloves and hands that gives an alibi in case somebody dies behind a bullet that flies out of the 9, takes another child's life on sight. Blood in the streets, no justice, no peace, no racist beliefs, no rest till we're free. There's blood in the streets, no justice, no peace, no racist beliefs, no rest till we're free. Hands up, don't shoot. Hands up, don't shoot. Hands up, don't shoot. Damn, a lot of opinions, a lot of confusion, a lot of resentment. Some of us scared, some of us defensive, and most of us aren't even paying attention. It seems like we're more concerned with being called racist than we actually are with racism. I've heard that silences are action, and God knows that I've been passive. What if I actually read an article, actually had a dialogue, actually looked at myself, actually got involved? If I'm aware of my privilege and do nothing at all, I don't know. Hip-hop has always been political, yes. It's the reason why this music connects. So what the F has happened to my voice? If I stay silent when black people are dying, then I'm trying to be politically correct? I can book a whole tour, sell out the tickets, rap entrepreneur, built his own business. If I'm only in this for my own self-interest, not the culture that gave me a voice to begin with, then this isn't authentic, it's just a gimmick. The DIY underdog, so independent. But the one thing the American dream fails to mention is I was many steps ahead to begin with. My skin matches the hero, likeness, the image. America feels safe with my music in their systems. And it suited me perfect, the role, I fulfilled it. And if I'm the hero, you know who gets cast as the villain. White supremacy isn't just a white dude in Idaho. White supremacy protects the privilege I hold. White supremacy is the soil, the foundation, the cement, and the flag that flies outside of my home. White supremacy is our country's lineage, designed for us to be indifferent. My success is the product of the same system that let off Darren Wilson, guilty. We want to dress like, walk like, talk like, dance like, yet we just stand by. We take all we want from black culture, but will we show up for black lives? We want to dress like, walk like, talk like, dance like, yet we just stand by. We take all we want from black culture, but will we show up for black lives? Black Lives Matter, to use an analogy, is like if there was a subdivision and a house was on fire. The fire department wouldn't show up and start putting water on all the houses, because all houses matter. They would show up and they would turn their water on the house that was burning, because that's the house that needs the help the most. My generation's taken on the torch of a very age-old fight for black liberation, but also liberation for everyone. Injustice anywhere is still injustice everywhere. The best thing white people can do is talk to each other, having those very difficult, very painful conversations with your parents, with your family members. I think one of the critical questions for white people in this society is, what are you willing to risk? What are you willing to sacrifice to create a more just society? Your silence is a luxury. Hip-hop is not a luxury. Your silence is a luxury. Hip-hop is not a luxury. Your silence is a luxury. Hip-hop is not a luxury. What I got for me, it is for me. What we made to set us free. What I got for me, it is for me. What we made to set us free. What I got for me, it is for me. What we made to set us free. You've been listening to an excerpt from the new song by Macklemore and Ryan Lewis titled White Privilege 2. You can check out the entire 6-minute song performed live on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert from his February 9 show. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dominic Araya, Jenna Yokoyama, Kanan Schlesinger, Jeff Henderson, and Tony Longshanks. The producer is Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representative about any issue, feel free to do so. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Jenna Yokoyama.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Rowland hosts a discussion with Preston Browning of Salvage Works on saving wood from old houses being torn down. Tomorrow, the City Council will discuss a resolution requiring the dismantling rather than the demolition of the city's oldest houses and duplexes. At 9, on Political Perspectives, Cenk Soderberg interviews Ellen Thomas, who has been part of the White House vigil to end nuclear weapons since 1984, about Proposition 1, a bill calling for the dismantling of all nuclear weapons in the U.S. and worldwide. At 9:30, Kristen Yount speaks with Rose Longaria, Regional Superfund Cleanup Projects Coordinator of the Yakima Nation Fisheries. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Chris Siegel hosts the KBOO Food Show. Do you eat? Then you'll love the KBOO Food Show. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And if you're in the KBOO neighborhood this Friday, stop by the KBOO News and Public Affairs Open House. That's at KBOO Studios, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue from 4 to 7 p.m. See you there.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Chuck Frayer of the Clark County Commission on Aging is an expert in housing issues and how they impact the disabled. The KBOO News' Lisa Loving speak with him about the commission's monthly public forum agenda for the coming year. Find out more about their work at clark.wa.gov. Follow the links to community planning and listen up.
Clark County Commission on Aging is focusing this year on housing, especially for people 50 and older. So, Chuck, we wanted to first ask you, why did the commission make that decision? Why focus all your events this year on housing?
Whenever we really started looking at all of the different issues that were in front of us, one really popped out that became a focus was housing, because it does touch so many different areas that we were looking at, and it is a major piece of today's world.
Now, you have monthly events all throughout the year of 2016, and so you're touching on literally almost a dozen different issues as they relate to housing. So can you talk a little bit about the community of people that is served by the Clark County Commission on Aging?
Well, we're talking about Clark County itself,